welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Hey, you ever notice what a noir city New Haven is? Me neither. But a new book released just this week attempts to find those noir moments and bring them to life in fiction. The book is called New Haven Noir. It's the latest in an endless series of short story collections published by Akashic Books, of works by authors in particular cities about their cities. Today in the New Haven studio, we have the author of two of the book's standout stories. One of the authors, Alice Madison, has been a familiar name to New Haven and New Yorker and New York Times Book Review readers for decades. The other, Hearst Sawney, is an exciting new voice on the literary scene, though a familiar voice to listeners of this program, since he appeared here upon the publication of his wonderful debut novel, South Haven. Welcome to the studio, folks, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
So how did each of you end up participating in a book, a collection of stories about the noir New Haven? Why did you jump in?
Well, I got an email from Amy Bloom saying that she was editing it, and would I write a story? And I guess, you know, when you're a writer, somebody says, would you actually write something and we will print it? You say yes. So I said yes. And then later I thought, noir, I don't know anything about that. I mean, I've read, you know, I've been to the movies, but I had no idea. So I started kind of trying to figure out, you know, okay, it would be gloomy. It's going to be raining.
Did you fall asleep, like binge watching The Wire?
No, I just, I finally thought crime, and then I thought, wow, I can write about crime.
You just wrote a novel where the Malik Jones murder was sort of hanging in the background, right? Wasn't that your last novel?
I think there's somewhere, yeah. I mean, I it's true. I've sort of written about crime.
And you have another one where the guy got murdered, right? Or he died.
Right, and I forgot about that, really. I was just thinking about that on the way here, that I thought, I have written about crime before, but it seemed very daring.
You never wrote it as, I don't remember you, and now my memory is a little fuzzy. I think I've read everything you've written.
Wow.
I don't, and loved it all. I don't remember now, but I don't have a good memory. I don't remember actually showing the crimes being committed.
Well, I don't
it was more
hear
like
either.
The way, yeah, right. It's because you don't pretend to write about what you don't know about,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
you write about the way people are sort of affected and at one level removed to have their lives affected by it, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say that's fair?
Yes. I'm more interested in how they feel. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you decided you're going to write it. So how did you bone up on being noir? Like, how did you get your noir genes going?
Well, when I thought about it, I thought Lighthouse Point Park, and I thought, that's a very noir place. The carousel is spooky, the weather is spooky. And then Amy wrote and said everybody had to say where they want to write, and I thought, everybody's going to want to write about Lighthouse Point Park. I mean, I was so sure that that was where it was going to take place. So, but then I think I just, I knew I had to have a crime in it. A friend of mine said to me, you know, in a noir story, the protagonist is kind of partly at fault, even if she's not the criminal. And my protagonist was a woman, because that's what I usually write about or have been lately. I've been writing, when I write stories lately, I write almost always about women at work. And so this is a story about a woman's job.
Although they always end up having an affair with somebody.
Yeah. Well, people don't work 24 hours a day. Right. So that's what happens in this story.
Yeah.
And I think noir fiction often involves work. And a lot of these stories have somebody's job in it and a kind of conflict between the person's personal life and job. And
so I'm thinking about, you say, what a great choice that was, Lighthouse Point Park. And you're right, that carousel is sweet, but it is kind of spooky, you know, when you're lost in the calliope.
Oh, yeah, and the weather.
Yeah.
I knew it had to be raining.
And now when I think about your story, I think, and when, you know, such a sign of a really good writer, I think when you're looking back at that story, is that you have them on the carousel, but you're a Dr. Frank.
Yeah.
We could say, can we call him the villain, or is that giving away too much?
We could hint that he might be the villain, yeah.
The guy who might be villain doesn't ride. Doesn't take the
he
ride
doesn't
that
go
everybody
on the
is
ride.
Taking when
no.
a bunch of adults and kids there.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a tip off clue, right?
Yeah.
Were you thinking that when you had him? What do you think when you have him not go on the ride? What was going through your mind?
Well, there's actually an answer to that. I never base things on real life. But years ago, somebody I knew was part of a work picnic at Lighthouse Point Park, and everyone went on the carousel except one person. And that person was absolutely not a criminal in any way. But I remember thinking that it's hard not to go on the carousel. And it made sense that this person didn't go on the carousel. And so that stayed in my mind. And so I knew that Frank would not.
Now, that's an interesting point you just said about you don't write from real life. Yeah. If something happened in real life that inspired you to write that.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's this thing about the way, like, if one argues that a fiction writer is actually writing about reality, you've constructed a reality that isn't actually happening, but for us to believe it as a reader, for it to be effective within the conceits of that fiction story, even if that means it's in the future or people are robots, it has to come through as real within that world that you're inhabiting. So do you think that you mentioned how you're not the main character here, even though it's a woman, maybe roughly your age, maybe not, I don't know, who's in the story.
I think she's a lot younger than me.
But at some point in your life is in a world you've been in. They're never you, but yet you are drawing from real life when you're trying to inject reality into made up stories. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, I think fiction has to be real in that way. And I think all fiction writers steal feelings. You know, maybe you got angry with your boss one day and your character gets angry with her lover, but you know about anger. I often tend to steal situations, you know, like just the little things that happen. Coming here and seeing you, meeting Hirsch, some little tiny bit of that could end up in something that had absolutely nothing to do with you as particular people or
I don't think of that as stealing. So when I think about, well, for instance, anytime I've tried to write fiction, I've been terrible at it. I think it's harder, and I think it's a higher level of reporting. Because whether it's how you're getting the way people talk, and then when you're constructing reality, you have to believe it, that they're really saying those things.
No, Paul, it's stealing.
You can't just quote something. You're not just stealing dialogue you heard on the bus. You heard dialogue on the bus, and the news reporter will have to get that quote right. You'll have to hear that quote. Then when it inspires you to make a situation that we're going to believe, you're going to think of the next thing that person might have said or what that person might have said in private when you weren't there, and it still has to be true.
Yeah, but the news reporter is a person of integrity doing what he or she does for the public good. And the fiction writer is a little bit of a criminal, I think, always.
So is the reporter. I mean, think about history reporting. That's all been...
Maybe so.
All these years. Yeah. I mean, I think the fiction writer brings us to a higher level. It helps us see our world. Like, I'm thinking of the books. I've just been reading all these dystopian utopia books lately about what's going to happen once all the environmental stuff happens, distraction happens, or once corporations take over world government or whatever. And all that, you know, all the level, how that's going to play out. And I think those fiction writers are carrying out at another level. Whether it's the Handmaid's Tale author's latest book about the, you know, where she has the future one, the dystopia, or Maurice Piercy, I just read one of those. I think they're helping us think about it, understand it, and confront the issues in a deeper level than someone who writes the news story about the latest report on global warming, which is important. We're giving you the raw material, the first draft of history. But also, I don't know that reporting is such a noble thing of public interest. I think trying to write and convince people, find out something that's true, even if it's in the world of fiction, is what the quest is. And we do it partly because that's what we do, right? You do something that you're born to do or that you love to do or that you need to make a living. And there are compromises along the way at every step. Like every time someone goes out to report news, you're compromised by your relationship with the source that you're getting the information from, and you're constantly battling, how do I stay true and get the information I want? I can imagine the same thing if you saw the person at the carousel. That person didn't commit a crime, but you used the word stealing. I would say borrowing. You borrowed that and elaborated on to try to tell us something true about Dr. Frank that is going to evolve in that story.
I stick to stealing. I think there has to be something a little bit compromised within the writer, and maybe within journalists too, but certainly fiction writers. And maybe that's why, maybe all fiction is noir fiction at some level. And that's why noir suits fiction so well.
How did you feel about noir, Sonny? You decided to do it. Why did you decide? How did you get involved in this? You're not as well known. Alice is a household name for New Haven literary circles. You will be. You're not quite there yet. How did you end up in this project, and why did you go along with it?
Well, I've been working with the folks at Akashic Books for you know, more than a decade now. In the realm of their noir series, like I edited their Delhi Noir anthology for them.
Which one?
Delhi in India.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, so you've edited one of these.
I've edited one of these. Yeah.
And what was that like?
That was a wonderful way for me to kind of collaborate with a lot of New Delhi or Delhi-based writers.
And plus, you have strong feelings about the kind of diaspora.
I do, yeah.
Indian writing that's gotten so part, whether it's Jubal O'Heary, what you think is the more genuine voice, not tailored for the American audience.
I do have some opinions.
Did you do that with the collection? And did you have any pushback from your publisher?
You know, I did, you know, it's hard for my kind of strong feelings and opinions about literature not to impact my writing and, you know, the curation of an anthology like that. The folks at Akashic give no pushback about helping people get iconoclasm and dynamism.
They let you free.
They let me do. They're the most supportive, wonderful, you know, publishers on the planet, which is why I was so enthusiastic about doing a story for New Haven Noir. Because, you know, there aren't a lot of, as Alice was saying, there aren't a lot of opportunities for writers of stories out there. And that too, even if you do manage to get your prose into one of the few literary journals that continue to exist in the English speaking world, you have a very small readership generally, except for in the New Yorker or something. But even the elite literary journals, you know what, a couple hundred people are going to read your story at the most. Whereas you get a story into an Akashic Noir anthology and you're guaranteed a readership of 100,000 people.
They're doing that well with these.
Some of them, yeah. You know, like, I mean, Brooklyn Noir, for example, and I'm sure New Haven Noir, they're, you know, anthologies that are edited by big names that draw, you know, kind of marquee writers in. They do get a lot of readership. And that's the appeal of the realm of noir and crime fiction for all sorts of, for me and for many different writers. For me, it has been a way to introduce unconventional and provocative ideas into the kind of mainstream cultural spaces, because the stories are inevitably readable when they deal with issues of crime, drugs, and sex.
Is that what noir is?
That's not what noir is. But
what
is
noir? Did you grow up reading Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler?
I don't know if I grew up, but you know, since I wanted to write for my, you know, for a living and write professionally since around the age of 18. I did read a lot of writers of crime fiction like Chandler. I've been particularly influenced by a French author of noir named Jean-Claude Izot. There's a man from Barcelona, the late writer Manuel Vázquez Montalbán, who has had a profound impact on me. And these are people who use these kind of devices and tropes of seedy red light district and a murder being committed and racketeering to really unearth and reveal some hard truths about...
Right, hard truth. And there's a sort of underlying idea that it's the naked truth about the naked city.
Yeah.
That somehow, whether it's the character Phil Marlowe or the reader, the writer and the reader sort of have this bond, I think, that they kind of know better than everybody else what's really going on in the underbelly of their city.
Yeah,
which
definitely.
Which can be sometimes a dangerous...
There's a certain narcissism there.
But, yeah, and for people, let's say, in New Haven, and you dealt with this in your story about the divide New Haven, and so does Alice, even though she doesn't name Yale. I have a feeling that's where Dr. Frank's university
apartment... I did. They changed it.
Why?
I don't know. But I had him say he had a Yale appointment.
You say a university appointment.
No, the editors at Akashic Books changed it to university appointment.
Did they tell you why?
No. Wow. I figured it was clear, but yeah, no.
Well, that's interesting. So we are getting to the noir behind the noir here on Dateline New Haven, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Today we're talking to two of the authors of the standout stories in a new collection of short stories that's been released this week called New Haven Noir. Alice Madison and Hearst Sahni. So let's get to the stories. But first of all, Hearst, before we get to the stories, what was the difference between being, so you, I hadn't realized this, curated, edited the Delhi Noir.
Yes.
And then you were one of the writers being edited by someone else on the New Haven Noir.
Yes.
How did that experience differ? You had power. So you're a critic. You're a literary critic. You have strong opinions that I love to read about literature.
Yeah.
And on the critic, you're on the sideline saying how it should be. And since you're in places like the, you know, you've had Times Literary, something place like us. So you're read by the people who make those decisions. You have some influence. When you're curating, you have the power. When you're the writer, you're at the mercy of editors who will take Yale out and make it university.
Yeah.
How did you feel in those two different roles?
I find both of those, all of those roles very invigorating and constructive and kind of defining of what I do as a writer. And they kind of just help me to do all that I do better. One gets to the point, I think pretty early on as a writer, when, you're barely making any money. You barely get any attention. I should say, I barely make any money as a writer. I barely get any attention. That you learn how to take the very constructive and positive feedback from editors that they have to offer. And I've gotten that from Amy Bloom, who edited the anthology, and from Akashic Books and countless editors I've worked with. And you also learn how to dig in your heels about stuff because, what's the point? You got to stay true to your perspectives and feelings. And what's the worst going to happen is that your story might get killed from a collection or from a magazine or a newspaper. And the integrity of my work and my vision is far more important than kind of meeting the editorial agenda of a magazine, newspaper, a publishing house at this point. Though, working with people like Akashic, they're generally just very supportive and constructive and help me kind of bring the best out of what I'm trying to do.
All right. Now, so you guys made a decision when you wrote your R stories. You didn't pretend to know what it's like to be the person who commits a murder. You didn't pretend to know what it's like to be the person who is selling drugs, a black kid selling drugs on the streets of New Haven. But you did write about some of that situation from the way you would know it firsthand. So Hearst, you grew up in Orange.
I did, yeah.
An Indian American family.
Yes.
And you were a teenager who had sowed some wild oats.
Maybe not.
Okay, we'll leave that off. Because okay. Alice said you don't write about yourselves.
I don't know.
At all, no relation at all. But in your story, the key characters, no, there are four key characters. Three of them are three kids growing up in the western suburbs of New Haven, teenagers who are sowing wild oats, trying to be down in the hood.
Yes.
And they go to the West River neighborhood to buy drugs on Gilbert Avenue.
Yes.
And they score from this guy named Ink.
Yes.
Who's a African-American young man who's the big drug dealer. They obviously see him as Mr. Cool Guy. You have this great opening, James, one of the white guys. There's an Indian-American guy by accident who's one of the three, and then two white kids.
Yeah.
And one of the white kids says, I got a question for you, homie. He says, when you meet the dealer. And the dealer says, oh yeah, homie. It's like, who are you? But then over time, they sort of, when they're going to buy the drugs, they do develop something of a relationship. All of a sudden, Ink kind of crosses that line and he lends them a record.
Yeah, yeah.
A jazz record, right? Which surprises them because they would think he's only supposed to be hip hop, right?
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have that intellectual world beyond him.
Exactly. They have a lot of stereotypes about this individual simply because he's probably a little poorer and involved with criminal activity, despite the fact that they themselves are involved with criminal activity.
but they know that there's privileged suburban white kids and Indian American, but middle class, they're not going to face the same consequences for the rest of their life, which I think is one of the points of your story.
Yeah.
As a black kid who has fewer options and, is serving them, they're the customer, and the black kid's going to have the criminal justice
Yeah, that is kind of an underlying theme of the story, though these children, like so many people in the world, aren't necessarily consciously aware of these facts. This type of privilege with which middle and upper middle class people, who tend to be white but of many different, races and ethnicities, there is a certain amount of privilege that enables them to move through the world with a certain amount of fearlessness, and they may not even be aware of this privilege.
I would argue that the real New Haven noir is the relationship that's complicated and often exploitive in unintended ways between privileged Yale-centered New Haven and the other world beyond the invisible gates.
But I would agree with you entirely on that.
So that's why I think you guys really got, which has nothing to do with how this book is packaged and a million miles away from how it is introduced, as though this book is really by people from the Yale world who are real gritty and understand what it's like. That's my two cents. But in any case, let's go to page 61. And you just described cross. You have a scene where the kids are getting to know Ink, the dealer, and they invite him to a party at a home of a Yale professor on, I believe it's St. Ronan Street, but you don't mention the street.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah, yeah. It really can only be that street. It turns into Edge Hill, but it's one side of that.
On the right side of Orange Street, the narrator describes it as. Yeah.
Could you read us what happens at the story? This is her, Sonny, reading his story, A Woe for Every Season.
A very, very kind of deliberately noir-esque, title, like a Graham Greene noir.
I don't think "woe" was a noir-esque
word. Oh, no, okay.
It's not gritty. I think it's literary.
Okay,
I'm hearing Vivaldi in the back. I'm sorry.
Okay, I was thinking like, I was thinking like one of the kind of darker Graham Greene books or something like that. And he was a writer who sat on this line between the literary and the noir that I find very appealing. A book like The Quiet American, for example, is so literary and yet so gritty and reveals all these very difficult, hard truths about politics, and that's something that inspires
me. Maybe part of
me.
The problem is that when Raymond Chandler sort of in his ilk defined it, and it was that style was taken up by the new journalists and some of the tabloid columnists. We all grew up, at least my generation, thinking that if you wrote in short sentences and wrote about that milieu, you somehow had some deeper understanding. When in fact, you kind of missed the larger point.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's hear the story. Let's hear it happen when they went to a party.
So I'll preface it. Can I preface it with one statement?
Yeah.
Paul, you brought up kind of the walls and the divides, but me as a writer, having lived in a lot of urban spaces throughout the world, Delhi, New York City, London, you see these walls everywhere, especially in our city of New Haven. We alleged liberals are kind of very wary of President Trump and the wall he talks about, which is horrific and shouldn't, scares me. But what I'm more interested in the invisible walls that we just permit to exist everywhere.
And of course,
everywhere.
Liberals all worry because President Trump said he would like to shut down newspapers and jail reporters. Since he was elected, the only people I know who have done that was state power, New Haven police, who arrested, confined, and prosecuted and stole the camera from a New Haven Independent reporter as part of their continual years-long refusal to follow the law on their own directives and a consent decree to respect the right. We all think we're so much better here, and there's all this nonsense self-congratulation about community policing. Most people don't know who the cops are on the street. Most of them are there as soldiers. No matter how many times they get sued, embarrassed, publicized, they have not even apologized for that. That was after Trump's election. And it was scary. So, yeah, I think Donald Trump's a scary guy, given what he wants to do. I'm more scared of what people are doing in New Haven, including the New Haven Police Department.
Yeah, and have been doing, for decades. These are systemic problems. There are three kids from the suburbs going to a party in New Haven, and they've invited their African-American friend to go with them. Drug dealer turning into a friend. Let's see how it turns out, whether there can be some kind of inter-community, interracial harmony and this evening. Once the day's transaction was over, Ink said, "So, ladies, any big plans this weekend?" Josh said, "Actually, there's a party going on tonight, right here in New Haven." Ink said, "A party? With actual people? I thought you guys just sat around getting high." Josh said, "Yo, why don't you join us, Ink? I'll get you a little piece of blonde pussy." As I write this, I remember being mortified by Josh's statement. No, Jenny, not the fact that he had spoken about females in that despicable manner, but that he had so openly alluded to the race thing. Later that night, we headed back to New Haven, to the East Rock section, an apartheid neighborhood mainly filled with Staleys. Close to $1 million for a Victorian these days, and $20,000 in taxes. Pay attention, Donald Trump. You don't need real walls in post-industrial America. The economics of it all puts up perfectly suitable metaphoric ones. I should be honest, though. I may mock those Ponzi East Rock phonies, but the second Jenny gets her tenure, I'm going to use her raise to get us into a sweet two family on the right side of Orange Street. So this kid Fran, Greg Franford, was having a party because his stale professor parents were away for the weekend. Fran went to Snobkins, an ancient and prissy New Haven private school, and Josh knew him from Jewish camp. His dad was a real hotshot in the history department, and I actually read one of his books a couple of years ago, Your Basic Justification for the Righteousness of Euro-American Rape, Plunder, and Pillaging, which is no surprise. That's how academics earn their keep in the 80s. These days, it's the total opposite. You get promoted by talking about the undeniable awfulness of white people. Two sides of an elite and simplistic coin. I'm finding it harder and harder to fathom how Jenny can dedicate her life to all that drivel. Maybe that's the problem. She still has faith in me and what I do and who I can be. But I look at her and her colleagues, and I see them for what they are. A bunch of conniving careerist drones. They don't care about art, about knowledge. They just care about grant money, about keeping their jobs and fertilizing their CVs. So about 20, 25 kids are smoking up and drinking down in Fran's father's mahogany-laden enormous third-floor library, which has ornately framed paintings of dead white men on the walls. There's also a painting of some natives near a bunch of huts, and someone tells me it's a $1 million painting by some guy named Gauguin. I don't give a shit about art. I'm just worried that someone's gonna see the link between my curried ass and those natives in the painting. Some cool dub music is playing. Stuff that Fran probably picked up on a fancy teen tour in Paris or Amsterdam. Stuff that me and my crew wouldn't get our hands on for another decade or so. I'm sitting on an ancient Persian rug, rather awestruck by all these good-looking, cool, and precocious kids. Boys and girls. Josh, James, and I have two friends who are girls, Karen and Olivia. They're pretty and cool, but total alcoholic waste products. Olivia, for example, thought she was pregnant in 9th grade, perhaps with Josh's baby, so she drank an entire case of Natural Light to force a miscarriage. These girls here are different. They're talking about French movies and punk concerts at underground clubs in New York City. James is next to me, packing bong hits for them, and they're willing to talk to us so that they can ingest our free weed and learn how to work James's tobacco master. And then Josh walks in with Ink and a friend of Ink's who I've never seen before. I'd like to tell you that our attempts at socializing together went well. Maybe some literary journal would publish this story if I lied and said that we got together for a hike and found a sliver of something in common despite being from different sides of the tracks. But that's not the way life works. That's not the way it happened. Ink is wearing an untucked polo shirt and a sun visor, the kind of thing someone would wear playing golf. His friend is tall and skinny, wearing a Malcolm X t-shirt and surprisingly tight-fitting jeans. I watch Josh introduce these kids to our host, Fran, who greets them with smiles and half-hug handshakes. Ink takes out a fat blunt, sparks it up, and passes it to Fran. Ink's Malcolm X friend leaves the library. I'm wondering where he's gone. Fran, Ink, and Josh are passing the blunt back and forth without talking, and slowly, the chatter of the party dies down. Everyone's staring at them or trying really hard not to. I have to help be a host, I think. Josh has the balls to make Ink feel at home, so I should too. I get up, slap him 5. I don't know what to say away from Gilbert Street, so I'm like, Ink, mad kids here want to buy bud. You're going to make some serious cash tonight. He raises one of his eyebrows and gives me a glance that I can't really read, then places a hand on my shoulder. He says, Ray, no business tonight. Tonight's about having fun. And then everyone loosens up for a while, and it looks like, for a bit at least, tonight's going to be okay. A group of boys and girls start dancing in a corner of the library, and I wish I could join them. But I just stand beside Ink and keep on smoking. Some white girls go up to Ink and his friend and flirt with them. Josh has his arm dangling over Ink's shoulders at one point. But then I see something weird out of the corner of my eye. Fran is whispering in Josh's ear all seriously. Fran's blue eyes are sharp and angry. Josh is listening intently, and he keeps brushing his brown locks behind his ear. That's what he does when he's nervous, which isn't often. At least that's what I used to think at the time. Josh comes over to us and says, Look, Ink, Frank knows about the car. Ink says, What car? Some dumbass model car, Josh tells him, then pauses. I can tell he's trying to choose his words wisely. Josh says, Some dumbass model car that's gone missing. Ink said, Oh, a model car's missing? What's it got to do with me? My mouth goes from New Mexico to the Sahara Desert. I'm waiting for Ink to get belligerent. If Josh were in this position, he would definitely get belligerent. But Ink shouts, in a loud but calm voice, Hey, Fran, fuck. Everyone stops talking and stares at Ink. I look over at little James, who's still on the floor with the tobacco master between the legs of his corduroys, which have been stitched up with paisley hippie patches. We exchange a commiserating glance. I think, James and I, we feel the same thing right now. We're both afraid of Ink, but we both feel bad for him, too. In that moment, I feel closer to James than I've ever felt before. Ink says, Fran, fuck, that's your name, right? You got something to say to me? Fran says, Why don't we take this outside? Outside, says Ink? You want to fight me? Fran tells him that he doesn't want to fight. He just wants to talk. In private. Ink says, I got nothing to talk about with you. Fran looks down, grasps his neck, looks back. Fran says, Yo, you can't be disrespecting people like that in their own homes. Says, I know people you don't want to be messing with. I'm wondering what the hell Fran is talking about. The toughest kid that this Snopkin son of a Staley knows is Josh Kagan. Ink looks dead serious. I could practically see the smoke coming out of his ears. I'm sure he's going to do something. Charge it, Fran. Pull out a knife. A gun. But he just lets out a disgruntled scoff, shakes his head, takes off his cap, and leaves without saying a word. His tall, skinny friend follows behind him. After they leave, I find out Fran's famous father collects die-cast model cars, and his favorite one, a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost, has disappeared. The vibes are horrible at the party now, so me and my posse decide to leave. We get in my Civic, and since we're in New Haven, we head down to Pauly's for a couple of quick cheeseburgers to lift our spirits. As we're driving, Josh, who's in the back seat, says he feels rough, that he needs a quick bowl to chill out. He grabs James's backpack, but James starts bugging out, says, "Yo, pass me my bag, I'll pack it up for you." But James can't stop Josh, who's digging around the bag looking for a lighter. But Josh doesn't find a lighter. Instead, he pulls out a model car, Fran's father's pint-sized Rolls Royce. Josh says, "Are you fucking kidding me, James? You little fucking rat." James says, "Fran's a fucking prick, he deserved it." I wish I could write about how Josh explained to James that it was wrong of him to let Ink take the blame, that James was torn up with guilt for the rest of the night. But none of that happened. We just drove in silence. When we got to the green, which was desolate except for the sleeping drunkards and crazies, Josh rolled down his window and chucked the Silver Ghost onto the sidewalk in front of one of those ancient churches.
Wow. Great. That was Hersani reading a memorable scene from A Woe for Every Season, a story in a new book out this week called New Haven Noir, a collection of short stories, original short stories about New Haven, the underbelly of New Haven, by Akashic Books. And we have two of the writers, two of the standout stories in that collection, Alice Madison and Hersani, here at Dateline New Haven, WNHH. Before we move on to Alice's story, Hersh, we're not supposed to give away the ending, right?
Okay,
don't
yeah.
you think? Because obviously the points we want to make are all crystallized in the climactic scene. And why don't we just tell people to read it?
All right. Whatever you like to do. I'm okay with spoilers and not spoiling things too.
I think I'd rather not spoil
okay.
it.
Okay.
Because I think if I'd heard that ending then read the story, I'd be so disappointed to have known.
Okay. Sounds okay. good.
We already gave away one secret.
Exactly.
All right. So let's give away a few but not too many secrets from Alice's story, Innovative Methods. So again, Alice, like Hersh, when you were doing New Haven Noir, you made a conscious decision to have the main characters be people from a world you're more familiar with. Not necessarily a job you ever had, right? But these are people, like, don't they live in East Rock, if I had a guess? Or they have college degrees. They work in they're working in an agency to help troubled youth.
They certainly have college degrees. Yeah, yeah.
And they're working with troubled youth, right? Yeah. And as you said, you set it in Lighthouse Point.
Right.
Do you want to do a precis, or should I just tell people what the story's about?
I could do that. The narrator of the story is a young woman who is a psychotherapist, and she works in an agency, a residence for disturbed teenagers, for troubled teenagers. And the other main character is one of the other psychologists who works there. The story begins and ends at Lighthouse Point Park on one particular day. And then there's a long flashback in the middle to the beginning of her getting to know this other psychologist. So did you want me to start there?
That's right. So there's a psychologist named Dr. Frank.
Yeah, Dr. Frank.
And this doesn't give away anything because this happens to being the story. One of the kids from this program, one of the really troubled kids, has gone missing.
Yeah, they're at the annual picnic of this residential facility, and one of the kids who we find out has had some problems.
Gavin,
he has
an abusive father, trouble with the police. He's black. Dr. Frank, I'm assuming, is white, although I don't think the story says that.
Dr. Frank is white. New Haven is a majority-minority town, and I wrote this as a majority-minority story. I say that he's white. I assume everybody else is black or non-white. The narrator later on turns out to be half Jewish and half Korean.
I did notice that. I said, so it's not Alice.
Certainly not. No, it's not me. I'm not a psychotherapist.
Gavin has gone missing. Gavin comes from a very troubled background. Frank is this sort of big shot psychotherapist there who's making progress with Gavin, right?
Yeah.
And getting some notice for that. And so what if you tell us, and then, so the two key relationships, if you tell me if you disagree with this, are between Dr. Frank and Gavin.
Yeah.
And what that says about power and who's helping whom.
Yeah.
And between Dr. Frank and the narrator.
Yeah.
So let's hear an excerpt about how the narrator's getting to know Dr. Frank.
Okay. One afternoon, a few weeks after I was hired, I stepped out of my office and observed Frank, whom I scarcely knew, peering through a corridor window. Something about the way he stood or his amused expression drew me in. He seemed as if he were about to say something outrageous. I was detecting that he wasn't a docile follower, but a skeptical observer. I was not happy in the job, which would lead nowhere. The administrators were competent but unimaginative. I needed a friend who'd raise an eyebrow, and Frank had such grand eyebrows. Out the window, sitting on the front steps, though it was winter, were two girls. "They're deciding whether to sneak out," Frank said. The kids were allowed on the porch, but no farther. "How do you know?" I said. "Nobody sits on the steps in this weather. They're making sure nobody sees them, but they're not too bright. They haven't thought of windows. Will you stop them?" "No." He shook his big blonde head. "They could get into trouble," I said. "Girls get into trouble by getting pregnant," he said. "But they won't want to miss supper, and they can't get pregnant between now and supper. They'll just walk to the convenience store and buy cigarettes. They'll get lung cancer," I said. "That I can't prevent," Frank said. He turned from the window. He was outrageous, but not too outrageous, I decided. He took an emphatic step or two, then called over his shoulder, "I hear you're from Philly." So I caught up to him. "Me too," he said. "We should get coffee." "I'd like that," I said. The first time we had dinner, we ended up at my apartment. I'd never slept with a man who had such big bones, such vigorous arms and legs. Frank was on all sides of me. We were Lita and the Swan. His arms glowed. His arm hair was golden, too. When eventually he got out of bed that first night, he clutched his lower back and then pulled a vial from his pants pocket, swallowing a handful of pills without water. "What's wrong?" "Sciatica." "I'd have brought you a glass of water," I said. He said, "I can find the faucet. I don't need water." He took many pills and never with water. "You're addicted to prescription painkillers," I said a few weeks later, and he shrugged, which startled me. I had intended hyperbole. By then, I was dependent on the sex, maybe a little in love, or at least more vulnerable than I liked. Frank would stick his head into my office and say, "Tonight?" or "Dinner?" without bothering with conventional greetings and inquiries. That felt thrillingly intimate. He couldn't get enough of me. But then he might become impatient and resentful, as if we were only in the same room at the same time because I'd tricked him. My stories about my middle-class, ethnically mixed family, I'm half Korean, half Jewish, bored him, and he said so. His cynicism about the job went beyond my irreverent jokes about Diane's love of rules or her assistant's fussiness about paperwork. He dismissed the administrators from his mind, as if of no consequence. When Frank talked about himself, he generally began with ambition, though I sometimes learned about something else as well. Hearing about a prestigious conference in Vancouver at which he'd been invited to speak, I learned that he was afraid of airplanes, though he flew often. I learned about the conference in bed when he took a call after we'd finished. "I've been hoping for this," he said. "I know what I want to do." "What do you want to do?" His talk, he explained, would include videos of him working with Gavin. He said, "One of my students is taping us, and after I show the videos, then I introduce Gavin himself." He paused, then added, "I'd better bring a chaperone. He has an uncle. My research money will pay for their plane tickets." Frank had some kind of university appointment. "Videos?" I said. "What about confidentiality?" "No last name," Frank said. He stood up, rubbed his back, and went to the bathroom. "But still," I said when he returned. "Still what?" "I just wish I didn't have to fly." confidentiality. No last name, he said again. I have his permission, of course, and he's being photographed from behind. Why bring him, I said, if you've got him on video? Q&A, he said. They'll eat it up. It all has to do with teenagers getting past anger and not letting it get them into trouble. What do you do that's so different, I said. I, too, spend hours every week with angry teenagers, and I knew that any of them might get into trouble at any minute. He was silent. Gavin's going to be the subject of my next book, he said then. I'm writing a proposal. There's interest. From the people who brought out your last book? From agents. That was a university press. Now I'm going big time. Soon, I calculated, Frank would be offered a more lucrative job in a bigger city. Did you want to stop me to stop there? Or
I want to go at the end of the section.
Okay.
Unless you're done. You know. Hey, you have,
I'll go
choice.
On?
Your yeah. choice. Okay.
Okay. One night at the beginning of summer, Frank and I met at a restaurant. He was late and came in looking rushed, whipping his napkin from his play section. Did you order for us? He said. I wouldn't have dared order for him. When we were finally eating, he said, I just confiscated a gun. From who? He shrugged. That's why I was late. From Gavin? Gavin? Of course not. Gavin doesn't have a gun. Who then? How did you find out? I'd rather not say. But don't you have to turn him in? I said. A gun was serious. The client might be sent to a more restrictive facility. I'm not turning him in, Frank said. You're not? What then? I'll keep it. When he's ready, he and I will take it to the buyback program. They'll pay me, and I'll give him the money. Won't he just buy another gun? By then he won't want one. I suppose he'll spend the money on books, I said dryly. In Latin, Frank said. Greek. We ate. Where is it now? I said. Frank shook his head. It's not in your pocket, is it? Forget it, he said. I'd intended to work on reports that evening, but had decided to postpone them when Frank suggested dinner. I expected that he'd come home with me, but at the end of the meal, which he paid for, I thanked him, mentioned the reports, and left while he was pulling out his credit card. After that, Frank was less interested in me. I was sure he blamed me for timidity. I blamed myself. Obviously, Frank wasn't dangerous. I liked him for his outrageousness. I scolded myself. But apparently, I couldn't handle someone who went beyond making lame jokes about the administration and actually tried innovative methods. Risky ones, yes, but taking risks led to progress.
Boy, so much of that is the story of Noir New Haven. That was Alice Masson reading from her story, Innovative Methods, in the new Noir New Haven. And I just want to unpack part of it. Like, part of your story has to do with when do you turn someone in, which is a universal story.
Yeah.
And who's turning on whom at what level, and we won't give away too much of that. Although, unlike in Hirsch's story, I would say I wasn't surprised in your story. I didn't feel like you were trying to make the cliffhanger such a cliffhanger. I felt like you were having this idea in the back of the reader's mind of what they was pretty sure was going to happen, but how do you get there? And it's kind of creepy along the way, almost like Hitchcock. Is that, would you say that that's?
I guess, yeah.
Or maybe you just don't think it out that way, you just tell the story.
Well, I guess it's true. I think the reader will guess.
But yeah, but yeah. In any case, it's like that part is so deep about.
But it gets more and more painful. But I hope.
When you talk about Yale's relationship, we were the model city, New Haven. We got more money in the city to test out social programs, urban renewal.
Yeah.
Yale people made charismatic, innovative, well-meaning to some extent people at Yale with strong egos.
Yeah.
Made their careers in social science by testing out models, ideas that could go on a greater scale, like Head Start, mm-hmm. like Legal Aid, things like that. But they always needed model subjects, like Gavin.
Mm-hmm.
And here, and it got very confusing about, it gets very confused about what are the motives and who's being helped by whom.
Mm-hmm. This is still true.
And I'm so confident that's exactly what was foremost in your mind here, yeah. That Gavin was making Frank a star. Frank was playing with Gavin's life,
yeah.
And walking along, right. Which, by the way, journalists, when you talk about these great integrity journalists, that's one of the not so nice things we do. But in any case, and then justify it. But I kind of feel like that's Noir story in New Haven. And then you made such a choice by how you ended the story about where it leads in that relationship. You are, I guess, without naming any names, you're very familiar with a lot of research that's put into practice in people's real lives in the city. Are you skeptical of the people who help them, or do you just think it's complicated? Obviously, not everybody's a Dr. Frank.
I think there are two kinds of people who help those in need. And I guess my story exemplifies that, that there are plenty of educated people working in agencies and quite honestly trying to get to know, respecting the people who need something and learning from them as well as helping them. And I think there are also people who do it in a much more top-down way and often do have a more prestigious university appointment.
To get ahead, you have to have found that case where you did something amazing and crossed the boundary and came up with new ideas about humanity and then promoted that at conferences with the bigger press.
That certainly exists. There's a lot of New Haven as a laboratory that leads to fame and
who are
fortune.
The subjects.
Absolutely.
And then
there are also people just working out their lives as social workers and case managers and directors of agencies, like the black director of the agency in my book is somebody whom I'm personally fond of. She has a little minor part, but she's just doing her best.
But what about those people working in the trenches with purer motives? Aren't they getting more tools to do a good job because of people who have a mix of ego and drive and great ideas and could think, like, often the people who are able to envision crossing boundaries in how we think about social science or poverty or health are also people in their personal lives who cross boundaries all the time. Dr. Frank crosses every boundary about whether it's the girls who are out there smoking, decides he could decide that rather than the rules, with Gavin and how he's going to deal with Gavin because it's going to advance him. But he also obviously had some success with Gavin that other people didn't have. And I'm thinking about people like a police chief who come up with community policing and thinks we don't have to be an army, but also doesn't have to follow the bounds of you when he has a child with a prostitute and hides it. And a lot of times the people who do great things that other people benefit from, including the workers in the trenches, are also people who have complicated personal lives and in fact do inexcusable, hypocritical things to the people they're supposedly helping.
Sometimes.
So what would we do without a Dr. Frank?
Right. I guess that's true.
Maybe it's not, though.
My wife disagrees
with me. She said Wallace Stevens wrote poetry and went to work in the Hartford and wasn't a jerk. He didn't have to be a Nazi.
Well, I'm married to somebody who works in social services in New Haven who is not a jerk.
He's a saint. Yeah.
A low ego saint. But who has never gotten famous at it. And who, as
a reporter, I've respected more than almost everyone else I've covered because of the integrity he has there. But it's true. He never calls the attention to himself.
He's never wanted a job where he didn't get to know actual clients, where he wasn't actually spending time with people.
And he never picked a Gavin that he's going to make his name on and then make some compromises
never
with.
Wanted to do
but
that.
To make your name, you often make compromises. So if you're going to be LBJ and pass the Civil Rights Act, you're going to do racist things to get there. I don't know. You wanted to jump in, Hirsch.
Well, I just want to say, I really enjoyed hearing that part of your story, Alice. And I feel like there is a lot of resonance between our pieces and the way in which kind of narrators are self-consciously kind of meditating on their proximity to kind of, ethical missteps, to put it lightly. But I think, this conversation, Paul's questions are speaking to kind of some of the fundamental issues that play out in the best noir, if such a thing were to exist. You know, the way in which individual humans are kind of embedded in inevitably corrupt systems and hierarchies. Mm-hmm.
The Wire. Which is considered the best modern example of noir done the right way.
Exactly. And The Wire is such a great show and shows the way in which...
embedded in those systems.
Yeah. Sometimes well-meaning individuals, like Jimmy McNulty in The Wire, have...
The mayor who wants to be governor.
Exactly.
And that helps set the stage for faking about the murders.
Tommy Carchetti, there we go. Yeah. So, I mean, we are sometimes, individuals who do seek to be ethical and do good are inevitably collaborating with and dependent upon other individuals and larger power structures that are inherently corrupt. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, can we harness that corrupt power to do good, or by engaging with it, are we too inevitably corrupt?
See, no journalist in New Haven is ever going to write stories like the two you wrote that get to those issues. We'll help you get these.
You seem to be getting there.
I think you guys do pretty well.
What's next? We only have a minute or two left. Alice Masson, what are you working on at Hearst Sony? What are you working on? You're both teaching at universities, not university is defined in this book, which is assumed to be Yale, but you're at Bennington.
I teach in the low residency master's program at Bennington College.
And Hersh, yes. You teach at Wesleyan.
I teach at Wesleyan right here, yeah.
But you're also still doing your writing.
Yeah, I have a recently finished unpublished novel.
What's it about?
It's about the 60s. It's about the Vietnam
years. What's the big one that just came out? The
Kite and the String is...
The one about the 60s, about the murder from the woman.
Oh, by somebody else. Yeah, okay.
What's that book? The big... I read it. It was like 800 pages.
I don't know.
The guy who spent 20 years on it, and about the woman from the 60s who didn't tell her son about how she got framed by this cop in the 60s.
I don't know.
Sorry, I have to think
I don't know. Yeah.
Sorry. So it's about the 60s.
Yeah. It's about the 60s, and it's part of it set in New Haven, and it's about a contemporary person here. I have a new paperback, and if I could mention that, that would be lovely, which is a book about writing called The Kite and the String, and the paperback version is just out.
And Hersh, what are you on?
Before I say anything, tonight, 7 p.m., Institute Library, launch for New Haven Noir. Both of us will be there.
Oh, yeah.
Several other contributors will be there. Institute Library, please do attend, listeners.
I forgot about that, sorry.
No, that's not the problem. I got my hand in a million pots. I'm also changing diapers of my 2-year-old and trying to get her not to use diapers. So these are the... But working on a novel, working on a nonfiction book. The 70th anniversary of India's horrific and violent brutal partition by British imperialists is this August 15th, and I just wrote a long essay about that for the Times Literary Supplement. It's going to be out in a couple weeks.
You forward it to me?
I will certainly do that.
I love the whiskey piece you did.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm sure I'll love this too.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today in Dateline New Haven. 7 p.m. tonight, Institute Library.
Yes.
Chapel Street near the corner of Church.
It's a beautiful space if you've never been there.
Check out New Haven Noir and some of the writers reading from the work you got a taste today. Thanks so much to Alice Mass and Hersh Sawhney, two of our treasures in New Haven, great fiction writers.
Thanks so much for coming on the air.
We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.